Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm getting started a little late, but I had a number of things I had to do today. And sometimes I say it's better late than never. In any event, it's now 5:30 as opposed to having a show begin at 5 o'clock on Monday as I normally do. So if you're not listening and you thought I didn't have a show, don't worry about it. You can always go online and check it out. Just look up Getting It Done. Dr. Walter Dean, host, Block Talk Radio, and you'll be able to pull me up. You got to search, but it'll happen. Today, Getting It Done will be sponsoring a show from the University of Washington, presented by the PhD Cornel West, one of the geniuses out there in the intellectual higher level of education. Let's give a listen.
And we're just so lucky to have Dr. West with us. Let me just give you a quick intro of Dr. West. I'm sure you know so much more about him than what I can tell you in a few words. But he retired from Princeton University, and he held a distinguished professor, class of 1943 professorship at Princeton University. But for a brief period of time, we lost him to his alma mater, Harvard University, where he received his undergraduate degree. And, of course, he received his doctorate from Princeton University. And then, but then he came back to Princeton, and where he retired. But he also has a distinguished record of teaching at Union Theological Seminary, where he started, and then now he's also affiliated with Yale University, Harvard University, Princeton University, and also University of Paris. Wonderful scholar, wonderful philosopher. Also, you're very familiar, probably familiar with his many books that he has written and edited. He has written about 19 books. Some of the most famous ones are Race Matters, Democracy Matters, and of course his memoir, Brother West, Living and Loving Out Loud. I believe that's but he's been on every imaginable shows, talk shows, from Larry King to CNN to NPR to national, international media all across the globe. And in fact, I think he's going to be traversing across the globe and has been for many, many years, really talking about these important issues. Among you, you're one of three, I think. You're either a big fan of Dr. Cornel West. Or someone whose intellectual senses were touched, provoked, or just affected by those things that Dr. West has to say. And it's really, really great honor and great pleasure to have Dr. Cornel West with us today. And so I'm going to turn the mic over to Dr. West, and let's hear for Dr. Cornel West, and welcome you to University of Washington, Bothell.
Can I use this? Oh, this is all right. Yeah, all right. Well, I tell you, I am so blessed to be here. We're going to have a good time. I'm glad we're starting early because I thought I'd have to apologize. I've got to speak at Berkeley this afternoon, so I'm going to be able to spend a good hour and a half trying to wrestle with some of these issues together. But I want to begin by, of course, saluting my very dear brother. I would go back to Princeton days. I remember his wonderful work there. He was younger. I was younger, but we still had the same calling. Give a hand to my dear brother, President Wolf. Yay! Absolutely. Dude, I want to salute Sister Susan. Where's Sister Susan? Where is she? Where is Sister Susan? There she is. Give it up for Sister Susan. Absolutely. I was blessed to meet with the student leaders earlier today. Appreciate the high-quality conversation. Of course, I want to acknowledge my dear sister, Tiara, because she was the one to facilitate my coming to Everett. Where is she? There she is. To Everett last night. And then we're going to talk about the great Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel at, I think it's Queen. What's the name of the church? Queen. I think you might know the name of that church in Seattle. Queen something something church. Very prophetic church, progressive church. Nobody heard of it, huh? All righty. I'll be there wherever it is. Whatever it is. But thank you so much for coming out. But I'd like to take this a little bit of a fire chat on what it means to try to wrestle with one's own calling. Because when I think about my own blessed life, it's not only that I know I am who I am because somebody loved me. Each time I think of what it is to make my own trek from my mother's womb to tomb, I think of the profound love and service and sacrifice that came my way, beginning with Irene and Cliff, beginning with my brother Cliff, two sisters, Cynthia and Cheryl, beginning with my grandson, Kaylin, and my son, Clifton, and my daughter, Zaytun, and then all of the teachers at Harvard and Yale, and at Union Theological Seminary, colleagues. You think of the magnificent faculty at this place. You all still have relatively small classes, is that right? Oh, so it's not a knowledge factory, right? No, it's hands-on. Give it up for your faculty, high-quality faculty. Oh, that makes a difference. That makes a difference. And in my own pilgrimage, and we talked about this last night, I've been in so many ways just obsessed with this sense that I learned from Socrates. Where he says, philosophy itself is a meditation on and preparation for death. And philosophy is what? Philo, Sophia, love of wisdom. Not love of money, not love of pleasure, not love of status, not love of wealth, not love of self, love of wisdom at its deepest level. And you come to a magnificent institution like this one, relatively new in terms of the history of colleges and universities, but at the same time, many of you are relatively new in terms of being first generation to hit the ground running. That means you got a hunger and a thirst. You can't wait to come here and learn how to die. In order to learn how to live. Because if philosophy itself is a meditation and preparation for death, it's not just physical death, but it's the death in life. And when you call certain assumptions into question that you have, when you call certain prejudices into question that you have, and you let it go, that's a form of death. Just like when you fall in love, and that old self is radically calling the question, and that new self emerges intertwined with another self with a smile on your face. Love is a form of death because there is no growth, maturity, development, or rebirth in life without something dying. Without something dying. And that's very important because we live in a market culture obsessed with superficial things, obsessed with feeding pleasures rather than enduring joy. We live in a market culture where people are more and more obsessed with just being celebrity so that you can be central stage, the peacock effect. Look at me, look at me, look at me, look at me, rather than the quality of human being that you are and your short move from womb to tomb. So early on, I learned that the quest was always about being great in the sense, and I'm a Christian, in the biblical sense. He who sees greatest among you being a servant will have a quality of service that attempts to engage in a fallible quest for unarmed truth and unapologetic love. And for we human beings, the condition of any serious talk about truth is to allow suffering to speak. We were talking about this with the students today. So when you talk about issues of diversity, you're not talking about some marginal and peripheral. You're talking about the quest for truth. But what is diversity? What does it signify? It signifies precious, priceless human beings who have been wounded and scarred and bruised. Humanity has been called into question. Human beings who have been terrorized and traumatized and stigmatized. It can be precious Jewish brothers and sisters in Jew-hating Europe. It can be our precious indigenous brothers and sisters in this land
through dispossession and the violation of their babies was the precondition of all the talk about American democracy. Wave the flag all you want, but listen to the precondition of that flag. Don't forget about the precious indigenous brothers and sisters. Oh, Brother West, that's a diversity issue. No, it's the truth. It's the truth. We talk about the truth. The treatment of women in domestic households, confined to private spaces, can't go to university, can't appear. This dignity in public space, that's not PC chit-chat, that's not political correctness, it's wrestling with the truth. The blue brown brothers and sisters, we're moving borders. I'm going to California. A few years ago, there used to be Mexico, right? Oh, we got to tell a story. I'll make that shift from Mexico to USA. Wasn't pleasant. Bloody war. Ugly war. Or it could be my own black folk. And so when I say my own, it doesn't mean exclusively my own, but everybody has R-O-O-T-S. And your R-O-O-T-S is connected to R-O-U-T-E-S. If your roots are strong enough, then the routes that you take will be such that you can embrace others. But if your roots are weak and you hate yourself, you put yourself down, you disrespect yourself, you devalue yourself, you degrade yourself, then your own U2ES is going to be highly problematic. Because you're going to go around looking for approval and recognition from everybody else in order to fill that void in your own soul because you haven't got your R-O-O-T-S together. That's why I'm always quite explicit in my talk about suffering or even my talk about unapologetic love. I try to have an intense and genuine love of everybody, but it begins on the chocolate side of town. Because that's where the depth, mom and dad and my own church, Shiloh Baptist Church, Reverend Willie P. Cook and Deacon Hinton and Sarah Ray, my vacation Bible school teacher. Never forget them. History remembers, let me learn something. We had a wonderful discussion with our dear brother today. And his precious mother in Washington, D.C., all that love coming at him. But he couldn't help but have a smile on his face given what she went through. And she still got a smile on her face given a smile on his face. At 77 years old, right now in Washington, D.C. He said, being honest and candid about what goes into us, that's also a matter of learning how to die. And I call it what it is to be soulful. Because I've always viewed myself as a jazz man in the life of the mind and the blues man in the world of ideas. And what is distinctive about jazz? One, you got to find your voice. And that's difficult. You got to find who you really are. You got to have the courage to interrogate yourself. The way Socrates talked about an example, life is not worth living at line 38 of Plato's Apology. But William Butler Yeats put it so well, it takes more courage to examine the dark precincts of your own soul than it does for a soldier to fight on the battlefield. Courage to wrestle with what has been deposited inside of you in terms of history and culture. Insights as well as blindnesses. Virtues as well as vices, because we all fall short. We were talking about that earlier today. Beckett's great line in his last piece, The Prose Fiction, Worse Will Hold was the name of that novel he wrote. He talked about try again, fail again, fail better. Try again, fail better. That's the story of our lives. And we come to your funeral and you in the coffin, they're going to say, how well did they fail? What kind of love? Of what? Was it of wisdom? Was it of labor? Was it of justice? Or was it about that thin stuff, that superficial stuff? And that's why when we talk about education, especially at this grand institution, but so many institutions around the country, it's really fundamentally about the formation of attention. How do we get ourselves to attend to the things that are crucial in our short move from mama's womb to tomb? And we live in a culture that's what? Producing weapons of mass distraction. That's what it is to live in a market-driven culture. The bottom line is profit, or as Wu-Tang Clan puts it, cream. Cash rules everything around me, but it It doesn't have to rule me. I can engage my own quest for integrity and honesty and decency and a sense of virtue and trying to have a virtuosity of being able to master whatever craft or technique it is, as a doctor, a lawyer, a scientist, or poet, or whatever it is. It is not just about cupidity, love of money. It's just not about venality. Can't wait to be bought. We live in a thoroughgoing market society where everybody's up for sale. And everything's up for sale. I'm not just talking about politicians. We need to start there. Across the board, the market has become the idol. So even market education, you come to college in order to gain access to a skill to get a job and live in some vanilla suburb. Little too narrow. We're talking about deep education, not cheap schooling. Nothing wrong with gaining access to a skill, and I pray God you do get a job with a living wage. Which means you're going to have some worker organizations, because some of these bosses, their bottom line is cash, 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 money, 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 me, me, me. We've seen it in the last few years. How many Wall Street executives went to jail, given the crimes committed on Wall Street? Zilch, zero, no set. I've taught in prison for 37 years. I'm teaching a course right now in Rahway Prison in New Jersey, 150 brothers. 62% of almost two-thirds of those brothers in that class went to jail for soft drugs. So you get caught with crack. The Wall Street executives can steal billions of dollars and have tea in the White House. And when they do get caught, what happens? Well, let's just negotiate. We can pay you some money. We know we did some bad things, but can we just pay you some money so we never have to take responsibility? Can you imagine Jamal and Leticia calling the mayor up when they get caught with crack? Can we talk about how much money I can pay so I don't have to go to jail, Mr. Mayor? No, it's a criminal justice system itself that shows it's tilted against the weak and the vulnerable. It's tilted against poor and working people, and especially those on the chocolate side, but not exclusively on the chocolate side. Something wrong. Something deeply, deeply wrong. And it's not just a question of name-calling and finger-pointing. We're trying to get at the truth, allowing the suffering to speak. And this is true in our own individual lives. If you think that you can be a person of integrity and honesty and decency and not come to terms with your own wounds and scars and live a life that we wear the mask in the language of the great Paul Lawrence Dunbar, you're going to discover you run into a dead end. You'll find yourself wrestling with spiritual malnutrition and moral constipation. By moral constipation, I mean you know what's right, but it doesn't flow. You just kind of stuck, you know. At least you know what's right. You're not a gangster yet. So the gangster doesn't suffer from moral constipation. The gangster's life is syndicates of Plato's Republic. Might makes right. I determine what's right. I have no conscience. I have no sense of right and good. It's all about my power. It's the will to power in the most crude way. That's something different. That's something different. And the gangsterization of a society, let alone the gangsterization of a world, is obsessed with just power and profit, with no space for non-market values like truth and love and fidelity and trust and integrity. It's a very, very bleak place, and we are in that place. I salute the young brothers and sisters of all colors here, because I grew up in the 60s and 70s. It was a different time. Oh, yes. Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, standing tall, talking about the war crimes of America in Vietnam and synagogues. Here comes Martin Luther King Jr. in churches and sites. What you talking about, Martin? I'm willing to die in life. I'm willing to give my life for what? Truth, love. Why? Because I have a hypersensitivity to the suffering of others, and that is my focus. What you got to say, Tom Hayden? What you got to say, Stokely Carmichael? Remember back before Stokely hollered Black Power on Bloomsday, June 16, 1966. He said, I've been arrested 27 times, and I'm not yet 25 years old. I'm tired of it. Black Power. Everybody, the press just picked up Black Power. Say something about why the brother went to jail so many times in gut bucket Jim Crow, apartheid America. How many times did anybody go to jail for justice? He already been 27 times. Why? Because he followed Martin. Both of them love warriors. They loving people, especially unloved people, the black people, taught to hate themselves, told we have the wrong hips and lips and noses and hair texture and skin pigmentation. Too many black folk believe it. The white supremacy inside of black people. I shake it. Learning how to die has got to go. That's true for homophobia with our precious gay brothers and lesbian sisters and bisexual and transgender. That's true for our Arab and Muslim brothers and sisters. Talk that they are terrorists by the corporate media. What a lie. Every community has its own gangsters. White, red, yellow, Jewish, Muslim, Arab, Asian, and so forth and so on. And I know it's true for black folks because I grew up with gangsters. In fact, I was a gangster myself before I met Jesus. I'm just a redeemed sinner with gangster proclivities. To this very day, I'm on the window. If I'm on the window, break out now. And let the Holy Ghost hold a minute together, God dang it. But the point is that you can be open to that in such a way that we're willing to come together, have conversations, and struggle together based on the distinctive features of the quest for truth and love, which is what? Acknowledgement of fallibility. Vulnerability. Can you jazz woman or blue man without being vulnerable? Put your soul on the table. Okay, Ray Charles. Okay, Stevie Wonder. Okay, Sarah Vaughan. Okay, Carole King. Okay, James Taylor. Put your soul on the table. I love about that tradition. I'm very critical of a lot of this contemporary music. I don't hear too much soul music. I hear a lot of noise. Because the culture is about body stimulation. It's not about soul stirring. I love Beyonce, but she is part of the culture, superficial spectacle. Give me Kim Burrell. Give me Anthony Hamilton. They echo Donny Hathaway. They echo Astrid and Simpson. They echo Nina Simone. They echo Luther Vandross. They echo Curtis Mayfield. Lord, I won't start singing now. You all know what I'm talking about. And these are not just entertainers. They're spiritual warriors. I grew up with a brother who played organ in our church every fourth Sunday named Sylvester. Knows of the world, Sly Stone. That Negro was a genius. What did he say? He said, stand. In the end, you'll still be you. When you've done all the things you set out to do, stand. There's a cross for you to bear. Things to go through. If you go anywhere, stand. There's a nigga standing tall and the giant beside him, about to fall. Y'all knew that song, 1970. You don't have to be born. You got the internet. How do you stand? Courage to think critically for yourself. Against the grain. Radical nonconformity. Shatter conformity. Shatter cowardice. Shatter complicity. No one full of purity. Everybody falling on their face. What's the quality of your bounce back? Courage to love. Empathize. Sympathize. Get inside of the skin of other folk. That takes courage. It takes imagination. Not manipulation. Imagination. You know that wonderful last line of Shelley's great pamphlet, Defense of Poetry? Poets are the unacknowledged legislators of the world. That's the great Shelley. Revolutionary Shelley. What do you mean, Percy? I'm getting inside of the skin of my Greek brothers and sisters struggling for independence. I'm getting in the side of the skin of my working class folk, even though I went to Oxford. Boy, that's the jump from Oxford to working class Britain, isn't it? Ooh, you can say a lot of such. You need a lot of imagination, maybe a little grace, too. But he did in his short, magnificent, poetic, and political life that Shelley, you see. That's what we're talking about. And the beautiful thing is that at this particular moment, we've got young people like yourselves all around the country and the world, now hungry and thirsty, for some quest for unarmed truth and unapologetic love in a world ruled by big money, big banks, big corporations. See, Trans-Pacific partnership reshaped the whole world in light of corporate interests. back into the United States. Stagnating wages for over 35 years. Profits breaking records. Last year, stock market, 30% increase. Dow Jones, 28% increase. Did it translate on the ground to precious working people? Not at all. What about our poor people? Hardly visible in the public discourse. What about the children? That's the measure. And it's not just their physical condition. It's the condition of their souls. It's 22% living in poverty, all of them. Precious for all colors. 22% of children living in poverty, the richest nation in the history of the world. That's morally disgraceful, spiritually profane. 40% of red children, 40% of brown, 40% of black children living in poverty. And yet no more outrage, no righteous indignation. Where's the holy anger? Where is it? Diffused. While we often are, quote unquote, amused by the corporate media and its distractions. Thank God for Amy Goodman and a few of the others trying to tell the truth. Trying to tell the truth. I salute my dear sister here in Seattle. I have none of that. What's the name, sister? Yeah, that's the one. That's the one. I have nothing, my dear sister. But Lord, she's on fire. She's on fire. But like anybody else, of course, she has no monopoly on the truth, but I love her tilt toward the poor and working people. We need counter voices, countervailing forces, counterculture, counter-hegemonic sensibility so that we have a much more robust conversation, and especially as it relates to education, because in education, as I said before, truth, love, knowledge, compassion, that ought to be at the center of it. You notice I didn't say smartness. I don't like that word. Let the phone be smart. We got to be wise. The highest compliment you can give somebody. Oh, she's so smart. That's not necessarily a compliment. Nazis had smart people. White supremacists have been very smart. Male supremacists have been very smart. A lot of homophobes, very smart. Something's missing. Where's the wisdom? Where's the compassion? Where's the courage? It embraces smartness. I'm not promoting stupidity. But it cuts so much deeper. And the direct connection between narrow conceptions of success. Give me my material toys, give me my status, and I'll be well adjusted to injustice and well adapted to indifference. Indifference is the one trait that makes the very angels weep, William James used to say. The great Heschel used to say, indifference is evil, more evil than evil itself. We create a whole culture of callousness and indifference toward poor people. Weak and vulnerable, you see, and think somehow the chickens won't come home to roost. Oh, no, you're going to reap what you sow. The earth is going to bounce back. Nature's going to bounce back if you have ecological manipulation and domination. Poor people sooner or later wake up. And when they wake up, we all will hope and pray that they tilt toward love and justice, and not hatred and revenge. That's why Nelson Mandela and Martin King are powerful figures. It's not that they just forgave white brothers and sisters for treating them and their peoples like cockroaches, but it's that they loved the people who were treated like cockroaches so a genuine and authentic way that that love spilled over with forgiveness for so many of the vanilla brothers and sisters who were indifferent and callous toward the suffering of black people. They go hand in hand to love all those treated like trash and still the human embrace, because no one moment fundamentally defines any person. And that's why you love other folk even when they're wrong, because you don't want to trump their possibility, trump their potential. They can change. Malcolm Little was a gangster, wasn't he? He was loved by the Honorable Elijah Muhammad so that he transformed his life. He learned how to die in order to learn how to live, and came up with Malcolm X. Who would have thought Malcolm X could come out of Malcolm Little. There was a life of love in a cell, turn that cell into a library, reading every day, and then having various study groups. And even he had to outgrow Elijah because Elijah was wrong. He said, white folk strike me as being devils. No, but some of them got devilish behavior. You're wrong. They're not devils. We all have propensities for devilish behavior. Malcolm had to outgrow that. And what a grand example of learning how to die in order to learn how to live in that autobiography of Malcolm X, revolutionary Muslim brother. You got people come with, can Islam be compatible with democracy? It strikes me as being inherently authoritarian. Read a little bit about Malcolm X and then open yourself to the tradition of the rich Islamic thinkers that are not confined to the stereotype. And of course, this is true of Judaism and Christianity, all of Hinduism and so forth. Is Hinduism compatible with democracy? They got cash shot through. Who do you think Gandhi was? Cut against the grain. Who do you think Mbeka was with Buddhism? Cut against the grain. Oh, that's education. Concerned with diversity translated as quest for truth, compassion. I'm going to end because we're going on and on. But I always end with the blues. Always. Because if you're going to be a long-distance runner, you have to be a blues person. You have to be a blues person. Because history is dark. The storm of catastrophe always already there. And so you have to be able to muster the courage to think for yourself, courage to love, and courage to hope. And hope has for me nothing to do with optimism, especially American optimism. Not at all. Hope is what Curtis Mayfield meant when he said, keep on pushing. That's not optimistic at all, because you got the dark clouds. B.B. King says, nobody loves me but my mama, and she might be driving too. That's the blues. That's catastrophic. But he has a tremendous fortitude. He thinks for himself. He plays Lucille for himself. Lucille plays him for itself, the guitar. See, and that's a great tradition. And that's very much for me what education at its best is about. Do we have the courage? Universities usually are not sites that put a premium on courage. They put a premium on ambition and success. The courage embraces ambition, but it says, in the end, not just a question of whether you're successful, but it's fundamentally a question of what you will be faithful to when you are successful. Don't allow success to be an idol. Use it for something. Same is true with privilege. Oh, I don't know what to do with my privilege. Use it. Deploy it for something bigger than you. Mobilize it for something grander than you. That's what we're talking about. That's what we're talking about. But thank you all so very much. Thank you so much. We'll have a good time for questions now. We'll have a good time for questions now.
That was Dr. Cornel West, one of a kind. Truth, love, and knowledge. This man is really a giant intellectually. Intellectualism just zooms from his mouth and from his thinking. Real forward concepts and his way of presenting them are uniquely different, but at the same time, worthwhile. We're going to continue with him, and this is him. The last one was back in 2014. Let's give a listen to him going back to 2016.
Stock market moving up, and yet pressured working people still suffering even more intensely now than they did before. So that the contradictions, I think, are becoming more and more clear. And
do you think there's any potential political fallout for Barack Obama? I mean, black people in this country are hardly the like, you know, going to vote in huge numbers for Republicans.
Well, when we vote for Republicans, it would be a waning of enthusiasm. You see, Barack Obama is in the White House in part because 97% of black people supported him. You know, we tend to want to give him time. But time is running out. You see, time is running out. It's very clear that he's been mesmerized by Wall Street. It's very clear that he's got close ties to the financial oligarchs and the corporate plutocrats who have a disproportionate amount of power and influence in shaping the American empire, and therefore the world. Investment bankers and others are being exposed every day now, not just in terms of scandal, but in terms of no accountability, no transparency. $787 billion for investment bankers, poor people, afterthought. And this is true for the economic team.
Barack Obama was never a left-wing economic force.
That's true.
Can you really be surprised?
Well, I think what happened was among the bulls, Sly Stone called everyday people that he had a sterling democratic rhetoric that reminded them at times of what Martin King and the others were talking about in the 60s. So you end up with a sterling democratic rhetoric on the one hand and technocratic policies tied to elite power in which working and poor people are secondary, tertiary, or afterthoughts, as it were. And this contradiction between technocratic policy, democratic rhetoric becomes more and more apparent, more and more manifest. And again, it's also a work in foreign policy.
So what is your actual policy desire here? You're talking about, in very broad terms, about huge chasms in the society. And we know that people of color in this country are experiencing disproportionate effects from the economic crisis, much deeper unemployment, and a tremendous loss of wealth from the subprime mortgage crisis before the financial crisis hit. So what do you actually want to see the president and the Congress do in specific terms?
Yeah, I think Brother Paul Krugman hits the nail on the head when he said, look, we need a direct job policy. We need an attempt to engage in full employment along with investment in infrastructure and education. And that's going to take billions of dollars, dollars that look like now will go to Afghanistan more and more. And, of course, Iraq was still there. We don't want to overlook Iraq as well. So we're really just talking about a kind of Marshall Plan. This is not revolution that we're calling for. This is just liberal policies regarding working people. We see the health care bill, you know, where the one particular option that connects with poor people and working people, the public option, was negotiable. The deal was made with companies, drug companies, earlier, before the debate even began. So, again, you can see the degree to which the system tends to be relatively broken in the sense that it tilts toward the strong as opposed to tilting toward the weak. Barack Obama moved into office based on a legacy of grassroots democratic engagement that said the weak, poor, and working people will be at the center. Now, he never was a progressive, he's certainly not a revolutionary, but he's a liberal. Liberals tilt toward the poor and working class, more so than conservatives. They don't tilt the way they ought, but they tilt more. He has been functioning much more than neoliberal, but when you look at his economic team and you look at his foreign policy team, you see neoliberals in the economic team, neo-imperialists in the foreign policy.
You had a brush with the most powerful of his economic advisors, the head of his economic team, Larry Summers, when Summers was the president of Harvard University and you were teaching there. Without getting into all the ugly details of your public and private spat, what did you learn about Summers and the people around Obama from that encounter?
Well, I think, you know, my dear brother Larry Summers, he has a history of being disrespectful.
You just called him your dear brother, and now you're going to rip into him.
Oh, no, I hate the deed and love the doer. You know, I'm a Christian, so that I forgive people, even gangsters, you know what I mean? But I keep track of gangster activity, and when it comes to me, I draw the line, because I'm a Jesus-loving, free black man, and I draw the line, and I will not put up with disrespect or being dishonored, but especially those who are even in less privileged positions than I am. You see, so when we talked about the famous memo about not worrying about the pollution in third world countries, we could put more pollution in
the World Bank,
suffering from overpopulation. He said, well, he takes credit for it. Well, you see, that's no plaything. See, African peoples are precious peoples, just like Arabs are precious peoples, Asians are precious peoples, Europeans are precious people, Jews are precious people, human beings are precious. I don't care who they are. And because I look at the world through the vantage point of poor people, which is the vantage point of the cross for me as a Christian, and concerned about the blood that flows, then when I look at empires, I see shadow activities. I see
1,000 military branches. I see a ship in every ocean. I see drone attacks that kill innocent people. I see torture in the form of force feeding and a whole host of other kinds of torture taking place right now, under American auspices, you see. I take that quite seriously.
If you track the deeds and condemn the deeds but forgive the authors of those deeds, Larry Summers and others on the economic side and the others on the foreign policy side who you've identified as the architects of these deeds, how do you, what mechanism do you hold them accountable? Do you hold them accountable as an American citizen? The electoral system doesn't seem to do it.
No, we have to have bodies in motion. We need organizing. We need mobilizing. We need demonstrations. We need voices to be heard. But the pressure needs to be brought to bear right away. We have to be critical. I think with Obama, first thing, especially as a black man in the White House, he needs to be protected because the right wing, of course, are attacking him viciously, and some of them want to kill him. He needs to be respected as a human being, as president, but most importantly, he needs to be corrected.
Let's talk about some of the other pressures on Obama, because we are in an extraordinary moment of political theater in this country. You have the Tea Party movement. You have Obama being accused of leading the country down the road to socialism, equated with Hitler in demonstrations, and a huge amount of ugliness, which is surfacing in American life today. How do you understand that?
Well, I think given the vicious legacy of white supremacy in the nation, 244 years of ugly slavery, 90 years of Jim Crow and Jane Crow, which is a version of American terrorism, because black people have been dealing with American terrorism for almost 400 years. To have a black man in the White House means you're going to get some white backlash. It's just understandable. In some sense, one is surprised it's not more intense than it is. But it is escalating. It's increasing. The talk radio show here, Brother Rush Limbaugh, he said, well, I call him a brother. Well, he's still a brother, too, but got to keep close contact with that brother because he's dangerous, very dangerous. He's got crypto-fascist elements, you see. But he could change. He could see the light, too, but we don't hold our breath. The important thing is that white backlash is escalating, reinforcing the kind of polarization on a racial axis because there's racist elements in it. It's not driven by race. Because in the end, it really is a question of them being upset that their corporate elites and others are being exposed in ways that they would never thought they would be exposed. Because they have tied their project, of course, to the Bush bandwagon. And that bandwagon was about greed at the top, indifference to the poor.
But there's a lot of rage in those Tea Party rallies against the giveaway of public money to the banking sector, for instance.
Yes.
So don't you have a complex mix?
Well, there are racist forms of populism that are at work. But for the most part, see, with Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity and Brother Bill O'Reilly, these are not populist. So you get some voices that are xenophobic populist, racist populist.
Are they racist, those guys, Glenn Beck, Rush Limbaugh?
I think there's racist elements in their discourse, you know, very much so. I think, let me put it this way, that some of what they say is in effect and consequence undeniably racist. That's different than talking about motivation and intention. Usually when you call somebody a racist, you're talking about they intend to, so and so. Thinking Brother Rush will say, well, Brother Clarence Towers is my best friend. Yes, and they are good friends. They have a right to be friends and so forth. But in terms of effect and consequences, undeniably racist, yes.
There's also an appropriation of the language of racism and of racial analysis. There's almost a reverse phenomenon going on when Glenn Beck accuses Obama of being a racist. What do you make of the appropriation of that?
Well, I think part of it is that the neoconservatives and neoliberals have adopted the colorblind discourse. So anytime you invoke race, somehow you are racist, mm-hmm. and they view themselves as colorblind. They try to reduce Brother Martin Luther King's claim about he wants his daughters to be judged by not the color of their skin, but the content of their character.
Glenn Beck loves to cite that quote.
I can't imagine, because Martin has been deodorized, sanitized, and sterilized by the right wing and neoliberals to such a degree that his militancy is downplayed. Martin never even used the word colorblind. He wanted us to be love struck. You see, I'm part of the legacy of Martin King. I don't believe in colorblind. You can't love somebody if you don't know what color they are. You can't love them if you don't know what gender they are. You can't love them if you don't know what their bodies look like. To be love struck is to embrace who they are, which includes embracing the best of their culture, the best of their history, the best of their heritage. But love struck means you're grounded, you're embodied.
colorblind means it's abstract and be manipulated by right-wing figures, and they're doing that all the time. And, of course, I mean, the funny thing is that the same folk who were colorblind about Barack when he ran during the campaign, as soon as he won, they talked about his blackness, first black president, my God, we made a great breakthrough, black people now ought to be satisfied, you got a black man in the White House. Oh, I didn't know he was black, I thought you were colorblind. I thought you didn't even know what color he was. You see how hypocritical it is? You see the discrepancy between what they say and what they do? So that in the end, it's not a question at all of being colorblind. The question is our humanity. All human beings come in bodies, in cultures, in genders, in civilizations, and we have to be able to embrace, be they Asian, European, Latin American, North American, whatever. Hold that thought. We have to take a break, but we'll be back with more of this conversation with Cornel West on Fault Lines in a moment. We're back on Fault Lines in conversation with Cornel West. I read a story in the newspaper this morning which reminded me of you and of your memoir, Living and Loving Out Loud, immediately. There's a 10-year-old boy in an Arkansas public school who was refusing to stand and pledge allegiance to the flag in that great American tradition in schools until all gays and lesbians have equal rights under the law. And I thought of a story that you tell about your childhood, and I wanted to ask you how you feel about that little boy in Arkansas today. Well, it reminds me when I was in third grade and refused to salute the flag because my great uncle had been lynched and they had wrapped his body with the U.S. flag as he hung from the tree. So I'm in solidarity with that young brother. I think it's a beautiful thing to bear witness to justice and bear witness to justice out of love. I mean, justice is what love looks like in public, and therefore when you have a love for gay brothers and lesbian sisters, which we ought to have, you are upset that they're not being treated fairly, that you loathe the fact that they're not being treated equally under the law. And the fact that this 10-year-old young brother in Arkansas has that kind of hypersensitivity to a group that so many people tend to trash and demonize, you know, I said he's spiritually developed in a way that all of us can learn from.
He's being accused of a lack of patriotism, and yet the conventional description of patriotism, very much still in play from the Bush era, Is it working in U.S. domestic conversations about foreign policy today?
Absolutely.
The Obama administration talks about a new era of engagement. You spoke earlier about a friendlier face of empire. What does that mean? Is that just marketing? Or is there actually a change in U.S. foreign policy these days?
No, I think what you have a limited terrain within the imperial context. Neoconservative, neoliberal. And Obama now tilts toward the neoliberal. So he talks about multilateralism. Okay, that's a wonderful thing. But is multilateralism that is real and substantive, or is it multilateralism still under U.S. auspices, you see? So it would be true in the Middle East, for example. Okay, now we're going to engage Israel in regard to settlements in ways that we didn't before. Well, you're still silent about Gaza. That's 500 precious Palestinians who the most massacre before Obama said a word. Now, the whole world knows those were 500 precious Jewish brothers and sisters. What did Obama have said a word? The next second he heard about it. Now, you see, I believe that precious Jewish brothers and sisters and precious Palestinian brothers and sisters have exactly the same value. So I am as outraged when Palestinians are killed as I am when Israelis are killed. And it's just a humanist position, and also a Christian position for me. So where is the righteous indignation? Again, you see the hypocrisy in terms of being fair. Well, you see that neoliberal option within the imperial context is one that has a certain kind of rhetoric that's different. But on the ground, we still don't have the kind of execution based on the precious value, sanctity, dignity of each life, no matter who they are, be they in the West Bank, be they in Tel Aviv.
It sounds like you're arguing then that when you put a friendlier face on imperialism, it's worse because it convinces some people that there's a change in policy when the spectrum is so narrow.
Well,
is it worse? Is it more honest?
It can be better because it generates new kind of progressive possibilities by putting certain kind of pressures on it. For example, even the debate about settlements. Okay, if in fact Israel's refuses to free the settlements, then all of a sudden the hypocrisy of Israel becomes more and more apparent. If no pressure was put at all, then that particular kind of moment would not have been manifest. On the other hand, if in fact we're able to show the degree to which a Palestinian leadership is in disarray and you still got various kinds of anti-Semitic elements being allowed to surface and so on, that also needs to be disclosed and revealed for the bigotry that it is. I do think that neoliberalism is in no way identical with neoconservatism. It's just that it's still within the imperial framework, and as an anti-imperialist and a humanist and a Christian and a leftist, I have to be consistent, even though sometimes it's a very lonely position.
You're also a master of dialogue, and you've been in dialogue with the Jewish community as one of the leading black voices in the United States in the last decades. When you look at the situation in U.S. policy towards Israel-Palestine at the moment, do you see the limits of dialogue? Do you see the limits of this endless talk shop when the reality on the ground is you know, so persistently bad?
Yeah, it's a good question, brother. You know, Hamlet says, words, words, words. And unfortunately, when we don't have organized bodies that can bring power and pressure to bear to change status quos and regimes, words oftentimes are all we have. They really are. There are limits to dialogue, but we still have to pursue dialogue no matter what. In the end, of course, you know, those with the cannons can speak last for the moment. But for those of us who want a change, do not have the power, the potency, the efficacy at the moment to change, all we have are words. All we can do is lift our voices, you know. I come from a blues people. Our anthem is lift every voice. How do we lift the voices of the poor brothers and sisters in Gaza? Not just against Israeli occupation, which is still quite vicious, but also against Hamas repression, which is ugly. How do we lift the voices of those prophetic Israeli brothers and sisters who are against the deeply conservative Israeli government that is fairly clear in terms of its unwillingness to be concerned about the deplorable plight of Palestinians under occupation?
Just to wrap up, it strikes me sitting in this kind of history-filled drawing room at Princeton, you are an Ivy League anti-imperialist.
Absolutely.
You spent your working life in elite institutions. Why do you stay in these environments, apart from the great salary and other perks?
You're right. It's a ruling class institution in the sense that it is in the empire at the very top of the system of higher education. But because it has so many resources and because it has such a rich tradition of being open to different voices since the 60s especially, people like myself, Michael Wood, so many others, who play a very important role in terms of anti-imperialist activity, Eduardo Godava, we can go on and on, are able to be here. Eddie Durant, my boss, my young brother who's my boss, he's part of the same tradition of being concerned about critiques of American empire in the name of what? Deep democracy. In the name of what? Substantive freedom and so forth. So it's a paradox in a way that that my own beloved Princeton University would be a place where this kind of anti-imperialist dialogue would take place intensely, unequivocally, sincerely. But keep in mind, I spent a lot of time in prisons, a lot of time on the street, a lot of time in studios with hip-hop artists, a lot of time in temples, synagogues, and churches. So this is just one context among others for me to bear witness, to be faithful until I die, to struggle for poor people.
Thank you for sharing this context.
What a blessing. Thank you so much, my brother. Definitely. Indeed, indeed.
As you can see, there's no limit to Dr. West's thinking. One minute he could be talking about the garbage man, and the next minute he could be talking about Santa Claus. And then when he finishes, tie both of those two entities together so that it all makes pathetic sense. I am... We don't have that much time left, but I'd like to see if you can, if we have a short one of him, because he's, and even though we only have about 5 minutes left, I'd like for you to hear Cornel West, the future of America depends on how we listen.
We are very happy to be joined tonight by Dr. Cornel West. He is a professor of public philosophy at Harvard. For good measure, he is professor emeritus at Princeton. For extra good measure, he taught at Yale just to keep everybody happy. Personal note, I'm tired of seeing him hang out only with Anderson Cooper on TV. I have been thinking about him since the start of this story and this drama. Dr. West, it is good to see you again. Let's establish, number one, that the movement never stopped and is still ongoing every day. And number two, birth is painful. Is that what we're watching? Are we watching the birth of something new here?
Well, my dear brother, it's hard to say. It's certainly one of the lowest moments in the history of this nation. I think that Brother Trump is in the process of becoming an American version of George III, with pharaohs and Pontius Pilate's versions of biblical religion. What I mean by that is that there is a disregard for the law we've already seen. There is a sowing of the seed of greed, hatred, and corruption, and you reach the chaos. That's what Brother Martin said. Chaos or community. You know, the great Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel used to say, the very future of this nation depends on how we respond to the legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. What he had in mind was, what are you going to do about your poverty? What are you going to do about your racism? Not just against black people, but against indigenous people, against Asians, against Jews, against Muslims, against Mexicans and Latinos. What are you going to do about your materialism, your addiction, the spectacle, and superficial things of money and commodities? And then what are you going to do about your militarism? Internationally, the military base, your drones, domestically, the militarizing of your police, and the ways in which that has a disproportionate impact on the weak and vulnerable who tend to be black people and other people of color and poor and working class whites, but disproportionately black. And this moment of reckoning, my dear brother, means we have a fork in the road. Right now, there's a massive crisis in the legitimacy of any leadership. Who actually speaking out? Of course, the Republican Party is following its neo fascist gangster who's the leader. The Democratic Party, neoliberal leader, we'll see what Brother Biden has to say, but it's hard to believe that he's going to be able to come through with what is necessary, even though he's so much better than Brother Trump. We must have a spiritual, moral, and democratic awakening among all of the citizens who care, recognizing we're going to disagree in the public square, but recognizing that we are losing our democracy. At any time, any society can no longer mobilize the best of its past. It could be Lincoln, it could be Frederick Douglass, it could be Walt Whitman, it could be Toni Morrison. It could be November 1 and all. But do we have what it takes? It's hard to say. If our system has become so choked by greed and hatred and contempt that it doesn't allow for reform, then the choice is between violent revolution, violent explosions that occur over and over again. And I'm opting for nonviolent revolution. By revolution, all I mean is what Martin Luther King, which is a fundamental sharing of power, resources, respect, and wealth, the distribution of wealth, what Brother Bernie was talking about. And I don't believe Bernie has a monopoly on this, even though I support him twice. But we are in this together. We hang together or we hang separately.
Well, you had an opportunity to hear Cornel West just now. We had him in three different segments and three different periods of time. The first segment goes back to 2014. The second segment goes to 2016 when Obama was in office. And the last one is now dealing with Trump 2020. And as he says, the future of America depends on how we respond. This is the 11th hour he's talking about. You have been listening to Getting It Done. And our presentations today have been by Cornel West. Hopefully you enjoyed it as much as we've enjoyed providing you with the information. Hopefully you'll listen to the show this coming Friday. So we're on once again Getting It Done. Will pontificate information that will be worth listening to. This is Dr. Walter Dean for Getting It Done. Have a good week, people.
But we are also a part of the world, and the world is looking.